Writers Festival. Thank you all for joining us. This is the first of the panel discussions across the weekend, so it's really great to have you all here. And it is about interdependent publishing today, so how we work together with our practices for interdependent purposes. We have Abira Kamran from Exhausted Geographies, Damaso Randolfe from Migrant Journal, Esther McManus from Feminist Print Network, and of course Sophia Niazi from UMC and Rabbits Road, and of course co-curator of the festival. I must also note that we have Minute Books in the corner there. They're going to be live illustrating the session. So I'm going to hand over to these guys to introduce themselves.
Hi everyone, I am Abira Kamran. I'm technically a graphic designer and a web developer, but I do a bunch of other things as well. And today I'm here to talk to you about Exhausted Geographies. Exhausted Geographies is a publication that I co-edit and design along with Zara Malkani and Chahana Rajani. It is a publication that tries to engage with cities and the city, specifically Karachi, and all the multiple realities that a city can be. So it's never just one thing. Like, a city has innumerable paradoxical, sometimes contradictory ways of being alive, and we try to do that with each issue. So just to give you a little bit of insight on Karachi so that you can understand the project a bit better, Karachi is the premier financial and industrial capital of Pakistan. It is also incredibly populated. I think there are like 18, 19 million people that reside in Karachi, and that's just the official, like, I think there are like 21 million people actually. It is also amazingly diverse in languages and culture, in ethnicities and religions. The reason why it's so diverse is because it is entirely a city of migrants. So we had the Muhajir migrants coming from India during the partition in 1947, as well as Afghan refugees during the Afghan War, and economic migrants that come all across the city, all across the country to Karachi in hope of surviving. So Karachi has these aspirations of becoming the next Dubai. Is insane, and one of the key strategies in this aspiration is the displacement of migrants. And I think that's not only shaping the present, Karachi's present, but also the futures that we imagine Karachi will have. One of the main reasons why we ended up making this publication is because there is so much academic and like political discourse on Karachi that paints it as a violent city. And not just a violent city, but a disordered violence, like absolute chaos. And so we had the urge of both participating in that discourse, but also the frustration and exhaustion from that discourse. Because like I said, a city is never just one thing. So the title of the publication takes itself from this fantastic paper by Irit Rogoff called Exhausted Geographies. And it speaks about that exhaustion when a land is being overdetermined and it can no longer sustain those claims. But the fantastic thing is that exhaustion, when something collapses, it opens up an opportunity for something new. And that ripe opportunity to engage in a discourse that is both critical as well as maybe hopefully honest was quite exciting for us. So we've so far done two volumes. This is volume one, and that's volume two. We did the first volume thinking that's it, we're done. And when we did the first volume, we felt quite excited. We felt that we hadn't exhausted the topic. But also we felt that people had an appetite to read and understand. And even though the project is located in Karachi, the insights and the learnings that we have from the project apply themselves even to cities like London, you know, all across the world. So the first volume is a collection of seven maps, and each map has an essay attached with it. And the maps range from like the historical to the poetic and the personal, and they're really fantastic ways of counter geographies, like a map that isn't just explicitly about borders and nationalist agendas. A second volume is a text and image pairing that speaks about infrastructures, so like roads and railways. And there's some really, I think my favorite essay in this is about railways, that if you get a chance, we have them open on the UNC table, so please browse through. That is an image from the first volume. The first volume has a good example is the first volume has a map that is a historical map that maps the cities in Sindh, which is where Karachi is, through genealogies. So it doesn't even use like territorial vocabulary to map a city. And I thought that was a really exciting way of understanding that not all maps need to reproduce borders. That's our second volume, which has a text book as well as an image book that work in sort of tandem with each other and have an interesting relationship. Each of those volumes are related to a larger research project that we do. And then when we publish a volume, we ideally want it to live outside of just the book. So we usually have an exhibition, we have conversations, we have talks, and that photograph is from a reading exhibition that we had in Karachi. Because I think if we can build a community around the work, I think that's the aspiration. Thank you. And that is our Instagram and our email. If you have any questions, I might be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for being here. I'm Damaso Randolph. I'm an architect, among other things, again. But I'm here as an editor, one of the five editors of Migrant Journal. Migrant Journal is, we always refer to the project with the same sort of tagline. It's a six-issue print publication exploring the circulation of people, of goods, information, fauna, flora, etc., around the world, and the transformative impact that these circulations have on space. So the first issue of Migrant was released about 2 years ago. And we have now just published the fourth issue. So being six, this means that in 1 year, the project is going to be over, at least as a magazine. And we often get asked, why doing just six issues? Why working on this only for 3 years? And I guess there are several reasons, but probably the main one has to do with the original objective of Migrant. As I was saying, the first issue was released about 2 years ago at the height of the so-called migrant crisis or refugee crisis. And amidst a sort of quite heated public debate that we found in a way quite quite one-dimensional, quite reductionist. So the idea was to kind of articulate sort of a response to this climate. A response that would be in a way rooted in what we might call like spatial practices, so architecture, urbanism, in general the disciplines that sort of think about the space. But the conversation had to be as well kind of transdisciplinary. So from the beginning, Migrant collaborates with artists, with scientists, with activists, in order to put together this sort of conversation or narrative about migration, kind of a minor narrative, if you want, a narrative made of many fragments and shreds that kind of come together. Well, okay. Another reason for doing just six issues is because nobody from the original team or the current team of Migrant Journal had any experience with publishing those six issues. In a way, it seemed more manageable for us. Maybe later we can talk about that. Then another reason for having just six issues was that it kind of allows the project to sort of establish a series of categories, kind of arbitrary, but in a way operative, to sort of look at migration from different perspectives. So every issue is thematic. And those themes kind of fall into two different groups. Some of these topics are more concerned with an analysis of the sort of the territories or the mediums across which migration takes place. And then there are other topics that reflect more on the very migrant substance, right, on the things and the bodies that migrate themselves. So quickly, this was the first issue that fall into this first category, an analysis of the territories, in this case, the rural space, the countryside. Because even though that the countryside has received some sort of critical attention, mainly from the architectural discourse in the last decade, in a way, it doesn't belong to the imaginaries of migration. When we think about migration, we think about cities, we think about ports, maybe about the sea. But never about the countryside, and still it's quite difficult to imagine a sort of transnational journey of bodies that doesn't happen, at least for a good part, through the countryside. The second issue, which falls into that second category of looking at the things that migrate themselves, look at the migration of capital. So how money circulates, how data circulates, the migration of natural resources across, of course, across sort of state boundaries, but also across different jurisdictions, different legal frameworks, even epistemological frameworks. The third issue looked at circulations that do not take place on firm land, so migrations across the sea and across the air. And the last issue that we have just released, it's really a shame, anyway. It's called Dark Matters, and it looks at migration and darkness. So circulations that happen somehow at the limits of visibility, at the limits of legality, even morality, from the processes of remittances of black money to the exit strategies that provide, for example, psychotropic technologies. And, well, maybe then we can go in more detail through this. That's it.
Hey. So my name's Esther, and I'm going to be talking a bit about the Feminist Print Network, which is still very embryonic, I get, at this stage. It sprang from conversations that were started at zine fairs about how to stay in touch beyond these like sporadic meetings that happen over the country at different times in the year. And an email that Cherry Styles, who does Synchronized Witches Press and Salford Zine Library and a whole bunch of other exciting projects, sent out to a handful of people, just kind of asking about how we could stay in touch and how to supplement these annual events that... that while they're amazing, like they're incredible for bringing people together and for encountering like some really exciting ideas, but also creative work, they're really heightened and quite overwhelming, I think, as a visitor, but also as a stall holder. So it's something we were interested in thinking about is how could we stay in touch beyond these things? What would these spaces look like that were perhaps more gentle and where we were maybe more feeling at our best and could maybe be more reflexive and have kind of more in-depth conversations, possibly about how we could work together as well. So we wanted to discuss this beyond this small group of people and felt that there was a real need for having consultation to see like if things that felt good for us were reflective of what other people felt like they needed as well, before settling on a final form for what we were interested in doing. So mine's quite surprising as well. So we sent out a survey at the end of last year to see kind of what creative practice was looking like around the country for people and what people felt would be helpful for them. So we asked a series of questions about what kind of creative work people were doing across a spectrum of print practices, what kind of things people would benefit from, like what people would maybe need support or advice with, and what people felt like they might have to offer to a network, whether that was like resources or skills or just kind of facilities or something that they felt like they could share with others. So we got some really generous responses from people. People really engaged with the questions, and it seemed from the responses, like from people who replied to the survey, like that there was a lot that they were willing to offer others. So there was a real interest in working together, whether that was like doing skill shares or sharing print facilities, or you know, having a kind of like open access thing with other people. And also we found that from the replies that people gave, quite a lot of people were encountering the same kinds of problems, balancing money and time to make sure that people had enough of both. So most people, I think, just full stop, are juggling like a whole range of different commitments and jobs and responsibilities. And I think also all of these factors led to people feeling this sense of kind of like creative and social isolation in lots of senses. So feeling like they weren't really part of a creative community beyond these like very thrilling, quite overwhelming events that, I mean, not obviously not everyone goes to zine fairs, but I think it's something that felt like it was not many people expressed that they had some kind of creative community that could sustain them. So it felt like a lot of people were experiencing that it was quite hard to sustain that self-belief and a sense of like, why am I doing this? Why would I keep on doing this? So that felt like quite a common thread through the responses. So reading through the replies that people gave, we were really keen to start developing some strategies, just really slowly and thoughtfully and in conversation with other people. And we started having monthly like general meetings taking place online to discuss strategies for organizing together and trying to figure out together how we could put some things in motion that are maybe quite complicated, like how to start having a collective distribution and whether something like membership or some level of commitment would be helpful for a network and how that could be something that was supportive and relevant for what we were wanting to achieve. And also we've started doing monthly peer feedback sessions. So these take place on Zoom, where you like we publish a link and you can click on the link and it takes you to this like online meeting room, which is kind of like Skype for people who haven't used it, but it's you can have up to like 200 people, which we haven't had. but you can do like breakout groups as well. So I think it's quite good for bringing together lots of people from the comfort of their own homes to share print projects kind of at any stage that they're at, really. So people, I think having as well like a regular space or a regular kind of time that people know they can come somewhere and ask for advice or support or offer support to others. And it can be kind of like a starting point for potentially in the long run bringing people together, maybe who are more local to each other, who can help each other with actually producing stuff. Or, you know, it can be like a start point for conversations as well as somewhere where conversations can keep happening month on month. So that's kind of where we're at the moment. And we've got some other stuff that we're in the process of developing, but maybe this is a good time to have a conversation here. Shall I?
Okay, so before we start the panel talk, I thought I'd discuss the context of the talk and maybe even of the festival a little bit more. So with the process, we wanted to move away from the idea of just having a publishing fair, and we were thinking more about the why and how of publishing and not necessarily the what of it. And with regards to this talk, some things that I've been thinking about are independent publishing is traditionally been used as a tool to undermine or bypass mainstream media, but does much of the independent media of today overemphasize the role of the individual and try to emulate the structures and approaches of mainstream media? The thing that really stood out to me about all of your projects and the work that you do is that it kind of challenges the structures and approaches of mainstream media or of dominant culture. And so I'd like to start by asking you all, who do you work with? You can just think of a few people who you work with and maybe discussing those relationships a bit. And maybe we can start with Abira.
Thank you, Sophie. It's me and Zara Malkani and Shahana Rajani as the core team of Exhausted Geographies. We edit and we design, but it's also the uncle who sells us our paper, and it's also our printer who we are in intense collaboration with, and who we think is quite an integral part. And it's also the city of Karachi, for which we collaborate with and have relationships with across a variety of things, whether it's friends, whether it's like the actual infrastructure that inspires our research. So they're both personal and professional relationships. that are integral.
Yeah, I remember, Abira, we talked about the most recent exhaustive geographies, and you went to Pakistan and you had it printed and you had to meet the printers. Yeah. And can you talk to us a bit about that experience?
Yeah. It was fantastic. I loved it. But we print in Karachi under severe limitations. For example, all the paper that we get is dead stock. So if we are lucky, we get the amount of paper that we need. And if we ever need to reprint an issue, there's no way of knowing that paper will ever come. We never know the grammage of that paper, except by like instinct and like touching and feeling. We never know the names. It's always like kind of bizarre. And I was just saying to Maso that we took an issue of Migrant Journal to my print. I took it. And I said, can we print as amazingly as he's done it? And I went through this whole period of being seduced by like better paper stock that maybe I could buy from London and then ship it to Karachi and all of those things. But sort of, I have to remind myself that it's important that the work that we're doing shouldn't just be about the research that we're doing. It shouldn't just enrich the artistic scene that hopefully we're a part of, but also hopefully the sort of like small printer setups that populate the city, and hopefully should enrich the resources that are available to us in the city. So the longer we have a relationship with those material resource providers, maybe we can all grow. And so that's really important to us, that it is an unrelenting Karachi collaboration from end to end.
So in our case, Migrant now is 5 people. It was founded by 4 people, Catarina Almeida Brito, a Portuguese architect who was living back then in London, now she's in Norway, Justine Trevillon, a French urbanist who is in London now, and Offshore Studio, a graphic design studio founded by Isabel Seifert, who is German, and Christoph Miller, who is Austrian, and both live in Zurich. And from issue 3, it's 5 people, Offshore Studio, Justinian Michaela Buse, who is German and lives in Basel right now, and myself. So that's the core team of the project. We also have a printer in Germany. And then we have this sort of mutant team of contributors that we found, most of them through an open call for proposals. We're quite lucky that people have an interest and we get so many interesting material to sort of make the next issues. And then some of the people that we know from past experiences, especially the interviews, are normally people that we are interested in their work, and we think they're gonna sort of end up, because normally the way that Migrant, every single issue is done, we kind of prioritize new writers, people that maybe are not that well known, that perhaps haven't published that much. And we tend to then keep one piece or two for more better known practitioners. And that's.
I guess like the people that are sending out the, because we have like a kind of occasional newsletter to say this is when we're going to be meeting online. So it's me and Cherry Styles who do the newsletter. But the general meeting where we discuss the things that will be interesting or helpful to do, it's kind of like a flexible bunch of people drop in when they can, or because we're meeting on Zoom, it's something where people can drop in for a small amount of time or not. So it is very flexible, and it is you know, it's in theory it's open for anyone who wants to drop in. Like the invitation is open, but we're aware of the fact that we're, you know, not really not. It's not like everyone is aware of the fact we're doing this yet. So we're probably not reaching that far beyond our immediate, you know, people that we know through the kinds of networks we're already involved with, through like print and self-publishing, because we're aware of the fact that it's not that we're really doing anything, like we're not creating necessarily like a new, I don't know, structure for people, but it's working within the things that already exist. But I think a reason why we're not putting lots and lots of energy into how to reach out further for a broader bunch of people engaged with print practices is because I think we're keen to feel that we've got like a genuine, helpful like offer, for want of a better word. So something that we think, we know that this is working, we know that this is helpful. please come in. We're kind of still, finding our way and trying to improve what it is that we're doing before we're just encouraging everyone to join in with what we're doing.
Just add one thing. When you mentioned that mainstream media has this sense like the individual and really like propels this one creator or whatever, one of the questions that we always get asked is like, but who does what? Like, who does the design and who does the writing? But who's the editor? Everybody always wants to know that between the three of us, how do we separate every responsibility? And it's very hard for people to grapple that there are practices that can be quite collaborative, like intensely collaborative and be enriching because of that.
Okay, I guess my next question, something that another thread that runs through all of your work is that you work across different geographies. You're not working with people and themes and content that are necessarily to do with your locality geographically. But at the same time, I feel like all of your work is about placemaking. And whether you could talk about that a bit and what you see, whether you see placemaking as important in your practice and how you see that. Anyone?
Well, in our case, we work mainly on the internet. Even though two of us, Justine and myself, are based in London, we don't see each other that much because we're traveling and it's not that easy. So we work on the internet mainly. We try to meet either here or in Zurich at least once for every issue. And the idea of places, in a way, the circulation across places, that's something that was very, very present at the beginning. I mean, many people were referring to migrant journalism and architectural publication in a way, which is something that is slightly dissolving, I guess. We think about places, but we also think about the people that, the people, the agents, let's call them, that inhabit and cross these places. And when thinking about who inhabits these places, we try to emphasize that it's not only humans, but also, I mean, quite fundamentally non-humans. So that's very much one of the sort of the paths that migrant is following now, sort of thinking about the non-human as an agent, which is equally important as humans in place making and place crossing in a way.
I think that term placemaking is actually a really nice way of framing it, and it's not necessarily something that I thought about it in that way before, but I think definitely like when we started having these conversations about being able to be in touch throughout the year and what that might look like, it was like the spatial void between everybody was definitely seen as this problem. So the fact that everyone's split up all over the country and that we're not going to be able to just work together all year round within like the same studio or something, that was definitely like, oh, here's a problem to solve. And I think increasingly we've been thinking of like how we can circumnavigate these things. So they're not problems, it's just the context that we have. So I think still we've tried out like Zoom quite a lot now, and I feel like I spend all my time talking about Zoom, and it seems vaguely ridiculous, but it feels like this thing which we're using. People can just phone in as well. You don't have to have like an internet connection. People just kind of phone up from their landline. So it does feel that something that is quite effectively stopping this being a problem. But I think we're also aware that I guess the Zoom environment feels like this place, a workspace, a social space, like all of these things at the same time, that feels quite accessible, and we're still really eager to find out like how we can make it work for more and more people. But I think we do feel that having real-life face-to-face meetings is sometimes really helpful. So we're trying to get maybe a balance like over a calendar year of how we could sometimes have things where people can come together and see what is different and special about both contexts. So I think it's, we're still experimenting with those things, but sort of like effective, helpful placemaking feels like a nice way of thinking about it.
Yeah, I agree. Placemaking is actually a fantastic way. I guess Exhausted Geographies is engaged in placemaking in several different ways. One is that I'm here, and my two collaborators, Zara and Chahana, are in Karachi. And that's actually quite good, because living in Karachi is a very all-consuming experience. Like, it's like walking through fire sometimes. And so it's good that one of us has some distance, and I think it really helps in the, I think, the editing process as well, seeing things in a more coherent whole. And secondly, of course, the project of Exhausted Geographies is explicitly a project on placemaking. And I really, what Damaso said really resonated, because it's not just about the bodies that inhabit the spaces, it's the infrastructure, it's the ecologies as well. And the more that we work on the specificity of Karachi, like the disappearing ecologies in Karachi, the roads and the railways in Karachi, the deeper that we dig in those topics, the more we realize that actually all cities function in so many similar ways, that this project of placemaking is both local and specific, but also transnational. And that is quite an exciting journey, I think, for us.
Okay. I guess moving on from that and thinking about interdependence amongst people and relationships, one thing that we don't often talk about is money and the interdependence of resources and where money comes from when we're talking about publishing and where it goes. So I'd be interested to know how you approach money.
Like I said, we were just going to do the one book. So Zara and Chahana put their money in. We're like, it's fine. We're just going to make it back. And we made it back through sales. And now we're obviously thinking about this as a series. So money is now a question that is looming on the horizon in a way that it was never looming before. And for us, it's like twofold, because it's not just so much, of course, money speaks and money affects the work that you do in so many ways. But also, a lot of the money that comes into Pakistan is from the development sector that has overt political and state-driven agendas. So you definitely want to stay away from that, because our entire project is critical of state agendas. And so we haven't quite cracked it. I was having a conversation with Masuza, but we want to crack it. But I think it's partly having a community of people who are engaged in the work, and then money sublimates itself, I think, through that. Faith is important, I think. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, where does money come from? We don't know. In our case, it comes from sales exclusively. We used to have a couple of ads in the past, but it was so much work that in the end we could not make it. So it's coming everything from sales, and we are happy that we are able to do the two basic things that we have to do as a publication, which is paying everybody that works for us or works with us, and paying the printers. And that's it. So now we have an invoice to pay to the printers for this issue that we just released, but it's been working like that. So sales are so important. In our case, it's what keeps the project alive in a way. Of course, if we had more money, we would be doing more things. And it's not only money, it's time, and finding money, it's having the time to find it in a way. But for now, we, as a project, are able to survive and operate in a way as a sort of charity, in the sense that any money that we make goes entirely to the next issue.
What you've said about money and time really resonates with definitely the responses to the survey, but all of the conversations we've had as well. And they're so inextricably linked with the kind of print practices that people are doing, where people are trying to juggle people's personal income will come from their jobs. So they're like, can I go part-time to work on this? Or people not having enough time to work on their personal print projects because they need to be earning money from another job. So it feels like the two are kind of the same thing. And it feels with the work that we're developing as part of the network, it feels like a key thing to tackle and I guess, kind of find a solution for is how we can ease the burdens that people have, like financial and time poor burdens, within some kind of structure where the burdens on the individual are lessened. So one thing that we're hoping to, that we're kind of talking about and hope to start doing sometime soon is starting some kind of like peer learning space where a small group of people can be coming together regularly. So it would require like a commitment of time from each person, let's say to kind of meet every month for like 6 to 8 months, where we could have like a peer feedback session, but over that period of time, by the end of it, there'll be a kind of deadline where everyone will have produced a new publication. Which could be launched all together. So, sorry, it's quite a long-winded description, but we kind of hope that that would reduce the financial burden on people, because if everyone launches something together and there's some kind of like Kickstarter or subscription service, then it's not really like this financial risk, and people can help each other to produce their work. So that can be like over the course of this project, people can order paper together or put in like bulk orders for things. So rather than one person doing all of these things individually, which could take a lot more time, it could be just a lot more expensive because unit costs are going to be higher. By working together like in a supportive way, it can reduce the financial burden for everyone and the risk, because you've got like a whole bunch of people launching something which could be of interest to more people. And while it's not necessarily going to be reducing the time that you have to put in to produce a new publication, by having this like structure and deadlines, potentially it could make it just you'd have that kind of support potentially. I mean, we haven't tried it out yet. We're keen to see if it's effective, but we think that this is something that could tackle that like time, money problem, because it is a problem, so.
Thank you, Esther. I think we're going to open up to the floor now if anybody has any questions, any of the panelists.
Hello. Thank you. I've got what might seem like a really obvious question, which is, why has Exhausted Geographies and Migrant Journal chosen print as their medium with all of its problems? And I know there's some really obvious answers, but I'm interested in your answers. Thanks.
In the case of Migrant Journal, again, there are, I guess, several reasons. One of them is that we wanted to make an object that people could keep. It's really difficult in the current economy of images and information online to sort of do something that, of course, it's possible, but in a way, I think having something which is physical, the internet is physical, I guess, as well, in a different way, but having something that lasts and that you can keep is something that works in our favor. And then it's not exclusively related to print, but the whole graphic element of Migrant Journal, which is crucial in the project, has, in a way, opened us so many doors. Closed others, because some people, I mean, design has these two ways of sort of affecting the perception of a particular project in people, but the object itself has opened quite a lot of doors for us. So that was unplanned in a way, but it happened.
Karachi is interesting because in the last several years there has been an upsurge of production in text, so like lots of artists working with textual materials. So in that way, Exhausted Geographies feels like of its time. It is part of an atmosphere of artists and academics working with text and producing independent publications around that, so it feels quite exciting. That's one reason. And secondly, this project, the book is a print book, but it exists in an ecosystem of work that we do. So we have a website as well, which is like an Ageson project, it's offstruggle.com, that attacks the same problems of like infrastructure and land displacement and just the project of mapping a city through like very digital narratives. And it's a completely different project, but one that informs exhausted geographies as artists is integral to us as well. And I see our Instagram as well as a way of contextualizing the research. So it exists in relationship with digital medium, but it's not exclusively print.
How many copies would you normally print per issue?
We printed 300 in the first print run for volume one, where we didn't realize that it would do well. Now we printed another run of 300. But we're being cautious. Even for volume two, we've printed an initial 300, and then we're hopefully sell out and print some more. So it's caution is key at the moment, because money.
My grant started with 800, thinking that it was quite risky, but organically, and we don't know exactly why, it got sold out quite quickly, so now we did a reprint, and now we did a second reprint, and for this fourth issue, we did 4,000 copies.
It's going about 4,000.
Okay. Oh, I'm a self-publisher, and so I make like 50 copies of things. I don't make many. I stitch them by hand.
So there are very big differences.
Yeah. I feel like, yeah, the stuff I make is, it's just like zines, so. Oh, what am I saying? It's zines, which are great, but I make really small.
Hi. Can I just ask about the readers or the audience for your publications? If you could talk a bit about that, and I suppose if you know who reads them and who you'd like to, if they're the same or different things.
I obsessively stalk anyone who buys a copy in any way that I can, because I'm very interested in understanding who are the readers and why are they reading this. And that's, I think, integral to our project as well, because we want to be in conversation with the city as well as the readers. So one is that a lot of, in Karachi, I guess it makes sense because people are interested in the city, so a lot of students and academics and researchers and even general, like, regular people will buy it out of interest. Outside of Karachi, universities are very interested, like I think, and specifically North America, not so much Europe, I don't know why. Like every university in North America has bought it. The Met is acquisitioning this as well for the library. So it seems to resonate there, and I haven't quite figured out why. But yeah, it's surprising sometimes the varied readership of exhausted geographies given its material.
Migrant, and relating it back to my last answer, we have a lot of graphic designers buying it, probably not reading it. We know that many people buy Migrant and don't read the articles, which is totally fine. Then we've got quite a lot of, if some people here buy Migrant Journal, many of them maybe don't read it. We have architects and kind of special practitioners as well, people coming from political sciences, social sciences, and then people that we have no idea what they do, that we meet at the first, and it's quite a lot of different people, and people from many places. Perhaps our challenge is Africa. It's just the north of Africa that we are present, or that we have been present, but not that much, so that's something that we are sort of looking at how to tackle for the future.
I wouldn't really know how to. I feel like the question was maybe for not me.
Hi, I just want to ask if are you interested in making publications that are multilingual, like bilingual, not only one language, like to increase your audiences? And if you are doing that, how many languages at the moment are you?
We've kind of dipped our toe in it, so to speak. One of the maps that we have in the first volume is an Urdu map. And if we were to become bilingual, properly bilingual, I imagine that it would be primarily Urdu, and then some regional languages like Sindhi and Balochi would be important as well. But again, the limitation is one of resources. For example, it is very, even Urdu, like digitally typesetting Urdu is a nightmare because there are so many specificities in the script that don't account for being translated into the digital, like onto a computer. And so that's one limitation. But I really, I mean, ideally, yes, I would love it. So maybe in the future, volume 3.
In our case, it's just English for many reasons. But even English, like none of us is a native English speaker, and we cannot afford a proofreader. So we, I mean, we do it ourselves, but it's one of the things that define Migrant Journal, the mistakes that you're finding every issue. So English is enough. Even though there was, I mean, some of the, and that's going to be important probably for the last issue, but even in some of the past issues, some of the contributions sort of tackle the idea of language as a migrant itself. And I remember a piece that I wrote for issue 2, sort of an indigenous cosmologies and how language defines, for example, a completely different territoriality, sort of completely different spatial logic, something that is formed and defined by language. So in that sense, it's important for the project.
I have an interest and kind of sometimes I make comics, but I'm really interested in comics. And I found that going to fairs like in France and in Germany, comics seem to be really, really well translated. Also, I've come across really beautiful, like small self-published comics that are in German, but they come with like small zines inside. That are in English translation, or they come with just like a postcard that's got very quick English translations. So if I did do like comic fairs again in Europe, I would definitely want to make like a small translation slip to put it in, or, you know, if I was going to be selling stuff outside of the UK. But my French is like not amazing, so maybe this is like a good thing for me to think more about, like having just as standard like French translation things put in there. But I think it's really important, and I love coming across bilingual publications to help me speak French better.
Something we're doing very quickly in our case is through the events we're able to sort of translate to this ongoing translation of the process. We just did one presentation in Barcelona like 2 days ago, and it was in Catalan. There was another one in Madrid, which was in Spanish, and I was like translating some of the pieces to Catalan and Spanish. So that's, I guess, an unofficial, ongoing mutant translation of Migrant in a way.
And I think we will wrap up the panel with that. And thank you very much to all of the speakers. And thank you for coming.